This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco on Lit Hub Radio, episode 153, Her Body and Other Parties. Today we read the strange, sometimes funny, mostly disturbing, and always feminist debut collection of short stories from the author Carmen Marlo Machado, entitled Her Body and Other Parties. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We're Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey. And we should note, when Ryder said Carmen Marla Machado, what he meant to say was Carmen Maria Machado.
Did I said it wrong?
Yeah, well, it's hard to read it because the I looks like an L on the book. So, yes.
Should I re-record my...
No, it's more amusing this way. Don't you agree, listeners? It's better if you hear me correcting Ryder when he makes mistakes.
Ryder is fallible and human, and Todd is just that guy.
Well, and also, look, people, we're picking on Ryder at a difficult time in his life. Ryder is 3 weeks out from the debut of his play, which I think some of you probably read about in the Vice article that announced that Ryder was still alive.
Yeah, I'm alive.
I learned something. Where you are.
So, yeah, I was like, I didn't know he was missing because he's been working consistently since he was 14 years old. But I think
for most nice of headline. America, my life ended in 2000. It's been 19 years of Ryder being under a rock. So, yeah, that was a weird article. I got the request for the interview, and I could tell by the way that the request came in that it was going to be written whether I did the interview or not. Because the woman who wrote it and who interviewed me has been, you know, that's just what she's been doing. And I was like the third in a series where she already did. It's like all the 90s teen actors, where are they now stuff. So I was really happy that when I talked to her, she was incredibly intelligent and super sensitive. And like, you know, she admitted to me, she's like, yeah, it's a clickbait, you know, style of headline, but the whole goal is to go beyond that. And I was like, well, that's good. And, you know, she let me talk about and be honest about a lot of things. And then when it all came out, I was like, Jesus, this is long and this is in depth. And it felt like, you know, a This Is Your Life episode or something.
Well, you know, it's funny because we all get suckered into, like, you're reading an article and then at the bottom there's that outbrain thing, you know, where it's like, who's the big-breasted star you forgot about? You're like, right. Who is that big-breasted star? Or it's like, you know, you'll never believe what happened to someone.
Well, and they do really shady stuff because, like, the one that I've had people point out to me that's related to Boy Meets World is they take a picture of Lee Norris, who played Minkus, and it says, you'll never guess who's transgender now, what child actors became transgender. And it's like, no, Lee's a working actor. He's still a man. What are you talking about? it's just because when people see Lee Norris and they use a picture of a female actress who kind of looks similar to him. So you have this moment of like, oh, did that happen? And it's so despicable. I hate that shit.
There was a great episode of the podcast Reply All that like looked into like that whole system of clickbait, because this guy, like, if I remember correctly in the episode, a guy's girlfriend had died or something. It was the worst day of his life. And all of a sudden that became like this clickbait article that was at the bottom of every article he ever read was a link to the worst thing that ever happened to him.
Oh.
And so they eventually ended up, you know, being able to get his story taken out of this thing. But like, that's what it looked like the article was going to be. But it actually ended up being like this really informative, interesting, well-written, compelling article about things I already knew about. But I was happy to read them. But like, every time I would share the article, I'd be like, just so you know that He's not been in the witness protection program. He's literally worked every day since the 90s.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of good stuff in it about fame and, you know, Ryder's constant grappling with it. So there is some explanation of why he isn't riding the child star highway to sell out
to addiction and sadness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of it is by choice. A lot of the, you know, 19 years of blankness that people see in my career is by choice.
Yeah.
Some of it is not, but you know, most of it is that I, yeah. But yeah, so my play is opening. That's what we should get out in 3 weeks. So if you're in Southern California, please come. It's a very small theater and it's performances over the weekends. It's going to be in Koreatown at this company called Theater Unleashed is the theater company that's producing it. Very, really small theater, but I'm, you know, I'm super proud of this thing. So
and where
I'm terrified that we're in rehearsals right now.
where can people go to buy tickets?
The Theater Unleashed website. We're going to announce it. Well, tomorrow with this episode actually will probably come out tomorrow, September 3rd. So hopefully ticket sales will go on September 3rd. So if you're listening to this, you can buy tickets right now at Theater Unleashed, and theater spelled the English way with an R-E, theaterunleashed.org. And you should be able to get tickets there. So please come see it. And, you know, I will be at a lot of performances probably. I don't know how it's all going to work out. I've never written a play before. So we'll see.
I'll be at least at one performance at some point when Ryder tells me it's okay to go, and I'll be periscoping in Julia. So if you see me with my phone up, it's just so Julia can watch the show as well.
Okay, so as the resident theater person for at least the next 3 weeks before Ryder eclipses me, your elevator pitch is bad. You have not said the title or subject matter of your play.
Okay. So the title of the play is Never Ever Land, and it is a fictional take on the Jordan Chandler versus Michael Jackson case from 1993. I never say the name Michael Jackson, so it's sort of left, you know, let's just say it's about a pop star and a very famous pop star and a child molestation case that ended in a settlement with lots and lots of money. But it's primarily a story about the family. The questions still lingering around this family that settled a lawsuit with a huge star and walked away millionaires. And kind of it flashes back between the 90s when it was all going on and 2012 when one of them is deciding to go public with a version of events that may or may not be true.
And you've fictionalized this, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So...
so it's allegedly. About...
That's a good way to put it. Allegedly, this play is about a very famous person named Michael Jackson, but we can't prove that.
Julia, what we need to do is we need to coach Ryder on how not to be sued out of his shoes.
That's your specialty. You've danced with that devil more than I have.
We're going to teach Ryder something about the slap laws, but don't worry. You'll be fine, Ryder.
You know, I mean, a lot of, you know, one of my favorite books, which I've talked about on this show before, it was a hugely inspirational book for me, is E.L. Doctorow's The Book of Daniel, which is like a fictionalized version of the Rosenberg family. And I just remember what I loved about that book and what inspired me so much about it was that this idea that in some ways, doing a fictionalized version of a historical event or historical set of characters is can sometimes get to a bigger truth about those events and and allows the author to really, you know, invent just the right amount of details and use just the right of real details in this combination that you know, really highlights the storytelling and the art that's in front of you more so than, you know, the question of what actually happened, or, you know, and that's what was interesting to me, is that this became an entryway to talk about fame and to talk about, you know, obviously some personal stuff that I have been through as a child actor. So it's all in there. But, you know, I have a lot to say about celebrity culture and reality TV. And that's really what I wanted to talk about, because I think that there's a direct line from our acceptance as a culture of even the concept of reality TV, the phrase reality TV, like, you know, it was never real. It was always, you know, now they call it unscripted, which is smarter because, of course, it's all structured to maximize conflict, to maximize drama. And, you know, I think that's debased all of us in the process. And that's why we have the president we do.
Yeah. That's your elevator pitch.
Well, I cannot wait. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. And once the show debuts, we'll talk a bit about the experience that you've had here on the show as well. Because I'll be interested to see what it's like for you to be on the other side to watch people acting out your words. Yeah. Was there any inclination on your part to act in it?
No, no. I mean, like, if it was going to help get it produced, if I had to. But no, you know, I'm not acting anymore. And it's so much more fun now in rehearsals to be watching what these actors can bring. I mean, we have such a great cast. I'm just amazed. You know, LA theater has kind of a bad reputation. And I've noticed, like, when I go to plays in LA over the last 10 years, they've just gotten so much better. And it's become just such a fertile ground for actors and directors. And so, for instance, our director, Michael A. Shepherd, I saw his production of a play called Rotterdam, which I think won the Olivier Award when it premiered in London a couple years ago back. But the production in LA was just beautiful, and Michael directed it. So I was able to get my play into his hands, and he jumped right on board. So I'm so excited to see what he's bringing to it. And then the cast that we've assembled is just, they're so brilliant. And, you know, adding levels. And also allowing me to cut. I mean, that's what's amazing too, is like, you know, you always, when you're in your own head, you overwrite something. And then when you see what actors, how they don't need so many words often, because they're able to just express it. So I'm thrilled, and rewriting furiously right now.
I can't wait. I can't wait. This is going to be fantastic. Yeah. And next year at this time, Vice will do another piece. Where is Ryder Strong now?
1 year later.
1 year later, since the debacle. Why has Ryder Strong been so quiet? Other than so hosting this show every week.
Let's move to Carmen Maria Machado's Her Body and Other Parties. It was published in 2017. It's a collection of 8 short stories. It became a finalist for the National Book Award. It won the Shirley Jackson Award, and then just a whole slew of other nominations and wins. And pretty universally, it's been praised for its originality and its daring. So what did you guys think?
The stories are not short. So it's actually a bit of a misnomer. So there's 8 stories in here, right? Yeah, is that 1, 2, 3? It's essentially like 8 novellas, to be perfectly clear. The shortest story in the book is 20 pages, which is a normal length. But like the standout pieces in here, which is the first story, The Husband Stitch, is 30 pages. There's a short story called Especially Heinous that is not a short story. It's 70 pages long. We'll talk about it. You know, it's a weird thing. I'm actually writing a short story collection that is due in, today is September 2nd. It's due in 13 days. So I'm in the middle of writing a short story collection is connected by theme, essentially, versus by character. And that's a lot of what Carmen Maria Machado is doing as well. You know, it's different when you're writing a short story collection and you're writing it specifically to be in a book versus to sell individually to magazines and journals and things like that. You give yourself a different kind of freedom. And so I've given myself the freedom to write 8,000 or 9,000 word short stories in hopes that my editor will cut them. And then reading this, you know, this is literary fiction, and sometimes I forget that literary fiction doesn't require a plot sometimes. because I'm writing really plot-driven stories right now for this new collection. But I was in times completely and utterly entranced, like by the first short story, The Husband Stitch, which I think is one of the best short stories I've read in 25 years. Yeah. And then periodically annoyed, like I am by Especially Heinous, which is the 70-page short story, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. And then sometimes feeling like, oh, it's a little indulgent, a short story about an artist colony. But at no time was I ever bored. Like, there's a lot of really great stuff in here, and the author is clearly extraordinarily talented. Just some big risks that, in my view, don't always pay off, but we can discuss that. What do you think?
I'm really glad I read it, because I feel like often I only get short story collections in my pile when I know they're completely amazing. So this felt like fun risk taking. I agree. I think the like artistic experience that for me it most matched was, and this is a very reductionist way of looking at it, but was Black Mirror, where you're like, I see the concept. The concept is cool. And a third of the time, it's like makes me think of it in the new way. And the other some, it's like, okay, not my favorite, but I get it. I get it. And then the other third, I'm just like, I don't know, man. I don't know. You got to have a whole book where you explored these ideas, but some of them are much better. I think it's an editing thing, honestly. Some of them are much better realized than others.
Yeah. You know, the other strange thing, and we can talk about this in more length, is that short story collections, you know, when you sit down and you read them and you're reading six or seven short stories in a row, that's not generally how the writer has written them. You know, like you're not supposed to sit there and spend 8 hours reading these short stories in a row. Like you're supposed to read one and then stop. And I think in a way that sort of mucks up the experience a little bit. And we can, you know, I can talk a little bit about sort of how you stack together a short story collection to avoid that sort of thing. But I think that's inherent in the reading of this is that, like, I started to see her tricks and I started to see her ticks, and that began to grate on me a little bit in places.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about what connects these stories. I mean, the title is actually really good. It's a perfect title because it makes you uncomfortable immediately, and you know, it obviously focuses on the female body in a kind of exploitative way, which is, I think, the most dominant theme throughout all these stories. And consistently, just the writing made me uncomfortable. The way she describes the body stuff, you know, like even just something as simple as like a nosebleed, I'm just cringing. So she's so effective at that. Like she's so effective at writing about the female body in particular, but any sort of body stuff, it really made me uncomfortable. And then completely messing with form. I mean, there's no consistency from story to story in terms of how she's approaching the writing itself. And that's pretty cool. You know, I mean, that puts her into automatically puts her on like, this is not, you'll never read a short story collection like this. So if you're looking for something different, if different types of storytelling or different types of fiction is something that you crave, like as a reader, you should read this book. Like I would, like this is going to be a book that I recommend to like anybody out there who feels that short stories are predictable or boring as a form, or that fiction has gotten stale lately, which I think, you know, there's an argument to be had that it has, especially literary fiction. So I mean, kudos for that. I mean, just, you know, that is an accomplishment in of itself. But
one of my favorite stories, even though I'd argue it's the weirdest story, is The Resident, which is a really long, creepy riff on a little Girl Scout rhyme, which I know it will give me nightmares. But that one is written in like a gothic style that we all, like anyone who's read Jane Eyre, like you immediately fall into the prose. And I would never have noticed how deliberate that was if I hadn't read the previous six stories that are all doing something totally different. And on that note, I just want to bang through the list and give the little like, you know, theme of what each of them are about. So the listeners get a sense of the range here. Yeah. So The Husband Stitch is amazing. It's a masterpiece. I think we can all agree. And it's a first person telling of that horror story of the woman with the ribbon around her neck through her whole lifespan. The second one, Inventory, is like a fun, light list of people this narrator has had sex with, but it reveals that we're in this post-apocalyptic universe. Really fun. I think that's a really easy entry point, actually, for people who would find a lot of these stories disturbing.
And that story, like, I didn't realize it was post-apocalyptic until, like, 20 pages in.
That's,
I was like, wait a minute.
Because
there's a point at which, I know, there's a point at which she's going through this list of people that she'd had sex with. And it's like, no one wants to feel this way during an epidemic. And I was like, yeah, fuck Trump. And then I was like,
Todd, you got distracted by yourself. Okay. The third story, Mothers, is And this one got wiped out by the story after that in my memory. So jump in if I'm remembering it wrong. It's a story of... Yeah,
this one's hard.
It eventually is revealed it's an abusive relationship of two women who had a child together. I don't know how else to like structure yes. that because it's a very strange story. The next story is the SVU one. Put mm-hmm. a pin in that. We'll be back to that insanity. The one after that is an amazing story about... women are fading away slowly and their faded ghost forms like sit in dresses that you would buy at boutiques, which is so crazy.
It reminds me of Amy Bender story.
Yeah, actually. Totally. Really good. Eight yep. Bites is about a woman who gets stomach stapling surgery and then the body that she left behind haunts her house. The Resident is about Girl Scouts. terrifying Girl Scouts.
It's a Girl Scouts yes, Yato is what it is.
And then finally, Difficult at Parties is about a woman who survives a horrifying trauma and then can hear the voices of porn actors.
Porn stars.
So that's the collection. And as I read through them all, like we should mention, if you read any review of it, like first of all, this is a really like sex-heavy collection, which is cool. We haven't really done anything like that before. And it's also really gay and queer all around. So that I'm sure that will come up as well as we go through.
And if you have an aversion to the word slick, as I do, this is not the book for you. Like I got a real aversion to the word slick. It's always the word that makes you. Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much squirming that I did while I was reading this book. I mean, when you're reading about people like the women fading and they're getting their skin stitched into a dress, when you're reading in the Girl Scout one with the when she's getting yeah. these weird pustules all over her body. Yeah. Oh my God! I mean, this collection is just painful. It's painful to read at times. You know, and. Kind of in a great way. It's so visceral.
And so the most realistic story actually in this is the first one. And it's realistic in a metaphorical way and in a literal way, the husband stitch. And I had to Google what the husband stitch is. And then I was like, oh God.
It's in the story.
Yeah. I had to Google it. And I was like, oh Jesus, why? I mean, I don't have children, so I was not familiar with that. Oh God. What's wrong with men? Can I just ask this question?
Well,
what's wrong with men?
That's a good summary of the book.
Why yeah. don't you just answer kinda... the question instead of ask the question? Put some effort in.
Come on, Todd. Now's your chance. Solve the problems. Let's go.
No, don't.
I believe it begins with our penises.
Yes.
That's the largest problem.
So the husband stitch is, since you've teased it, now we have to describe it.
Yeah.
After a woman gives birth and she has some very normal vaginal tearing, the doctor, it used to be...
We've never said that sentence ever on this show before.
Well, I've said it all the time, so...
Jesus.
The doctor, I don't know how actually common this is, but the husband stitch is the idea that the doctor puts in an extra stitch so that the woman is tighter... for more pleasurable sex for her husband, which is just absolutely brutal and insane. But let's talk about the story in general, because that's just one small, very small part.
Well, I think that, you know, I think one of the things we definitely should point out is all the allusions to Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the yes. Alvin Schwartz collection, which we've talked about on this show before. You know, that had the original Ribbon story in it, but there's also The Hook and Cold as Clay. And I think there's like six or seven references yeah. to those stories in this story. And they're really brilliantly woven in. And, you know, I think this story is the best in the whole collection by far. And, but it also sets up the sort of, just the world building, which is she has such a strange way of building her worlds that even after the story is over, you're not sure where the realism ends and the fantastic elements begin. Like it's very hard to pin down, and you know, like I heard that this book has been optioned for a TV show or a movie or something. And it's like, I can't imagine what you could, how you could make these.
Because I don't know, man. You know, they make anything now.
I guess
like,
so.
Like, there's nothing that's off limits.
I guess so. But this, you know, this is just a, these are such literary techniques that she's using, you know, drifting in and out of like first person and announcing how to read it aloud.
Yeah.
Like that.
So that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to talk about. So at the top of the story, in a parenthetical, it says, if you read this story out loud, please use the following voices. Me, as a child, high-pitched, forgettable. As a woman, the same. Mm-hmm. The boy who'll grow into a man and be my spouse, robust, with serendipity. My father, kind, booming, like your father, or the man you wish was your father. Mm-hmm. My son, as a small child, gentle, sounding with the faintest of lisps, as a man, like my husband. All other women, interchangeable with my own. And then at the end of sections, she'll have further directions for the staging of the reading of this. Let's see here. Where is one of them? If you are reading the story out loud, make the sound of the bed under the tension of train travel and lovemaking by straining a metal folding chair against its hinges. When you are exhausted with that, sing the half-remembered lyrics of old songs to the person closest to you, thinking of lullabies for children. Oh. It's really weird, but it's also super cool. But it's also, so I said it's the most realistic story, which might seem odd in light of everything that we've said. But in fact, the action that's happening to the main character with her husband and with her child and with the emotional and physical relationships between all of these folks is a realistic story. But it's buttressed by the fact that she has this ribbon around her neck that her husband always wants to touch. And she always says, no, that's my thing. And he says, you know, there should be no secrets between our between spouses, all this stuff. And then it concludes with them making love after their child has gone off to college and they've rechristened their house. And the husband pulls the bow and her head falls off.
Just spoiled the whole thing, but I guess you already knew that.
That's the part we know. So,
right,
you know,
yeah, right.
For me, it was like, I was like, ooh, green ribbon around her neck. I know what that's for.
It becomes a metaphor, a larger metaphor than just what the scary story is. And so when it ends, you know, the final paragraph is, my weight shifts, and with it, gravity seizes me. My husband's face falls away, and then I see the ceiling and the wall behind me. As my lopped head tips backward off my neck and rolls off the bed, I feel as lonely as I have ever been. Yeah. Like, well, that's significantly more meaningful than the scary stories I recall reading as a child.
Yeah, so part of the world building, let me jump in, is that she's not the only one that has a ribbon. All women have a ribbon. Around a different part of their body, which we only learn from like one or two other quick examples, but it is obvious that the ribbon is standing for this like holy, sacred part of themselves that women keep, keep for themselves, and that no one else can touch it and have it. It's just, she says, like, it's just for me. I do want to read this page that Todd summarized because it's so beautiful, and like the experience of going from this experience with her husband to with her child is, I don't know, it was emotionally huge for me. So she has this baby, it's a son, and there's a few pages of like absolutely rhapsodic happiness with this baby. But then here we go. Her husband is trying to get her to have sex with him, and he says, come back here. No, I say, you'll touch my ribbon. He stands up and tucks himself into his pants, zipping them up. A wife, he said, should have no secrets from her husband. I don't have any secrets, I tell him. The ribbon. The ribbon is not a secret. It's just mine. Were you born with it? Why your throat? Why is it green? I do not answer. He is silent for a long minute. Then, a wife should have no secrets. My nose grows hot. I do not want to cry. I've given you everything you have ever asked for, I say. Am I not allowed this one thing? I want to know. You think you want to know, I say, but you don't. Why do you want to hide it from me? I'm not hiding it. It just isn't yours. He gets down very close to me, and I pull back from the smell of bourbon. I hear a creak, and we both look up to see our son's feet vanishing up the staircase. When my husband goes to sleep that night, he does so with a hot and burning anger that falls away as soon as he is truly dreaming. I am up for a long time listening to his breathing, wondering if perhaps men have ribbons that do not look like ribbons. Maybe we're all marked in some way, even if it's impossible to see. The next day, this is my favorite part. The next day, our son touches my throat and asks about my ribbon. He tries to pull at it, and though it pains me, I have to make it forbidden to him. When he reaches for it, I shake a can full of pennies. It crashes discordantly, and he withdraws and weeps. Something is lost between us, and I never find it again. If you're reading the story out loud, prepare a soda can full of pennies. When you arrive at this moment, shake it loudly in the face of the people closest to you. Observe their expression of startled fear and then betrayal. Notice how they never look at you exactly the same way for the rest of your days.
Yeah.
That description of what it is like to raise a son who suddenly becomes curious about your sense of sexuality or womanhood or privacy, mm-hmm. and going from like your one person to one person like prodding into the edge. I think one of the best parts
of, I mean, because, you know, obviously, like you were pointing out, Todd, it's this metaphor for the exploitation of women's bodies, or the access that men feel that they have to women's right. bodies. And what's so brilliant about it is that the husband is not an abusive asshole. You know, the story begins with her love for him and her seducing him in a way, you know, her mm-hmm. falling for him. So it's really smart, you know, and more subtle and interesting than, like, you know, if it were just like, I have a, you know, horrible husband who wants to always, you know, have sex with me and have his way. It's more messy than that. It's more human right. and more realistic in terms of, like, you know, the way people actually do, you know, crave access to each other's bodies, or, you know, it's really, really interesting. And yeah, that scene, what you just read, Julia, is like, that's the core of the entire mm-hmm. story and mm-hmm. this entire book, I think.
And it's also why I think this story, I mean, it's just an incredible piece of work. It's one of these stories that I have to redo my syllabus, as it were, you know, so I can include this for some of my students to read. But it takes big risks. It has a huge metaphor, but it also boils down to being about a character and about being a first and foremost about a person and not the image of the person. Right. So as a, like, when I'm teaching creative writing and teaching short story writing, and oftentimes my students want to write surreal fiction and be like, well, I'm going to set this on the head of a pin. Well, that doesn't fucking mean anything, you know, like, right. don't set your fucking story on the head of a pin. Do something like this. You know, if you're going to write surrealist fiction, you know, use surrealism to stand in the place for the things that you cannot espouse in reality.
Right.
And she does that extraordinarily well. Like, to the level that I think a comparison to Amy Bender, but also Kelly Link. And I think Kelly Link is more accurate when you look at stories like The Resident, which is the weird Girl Scout story. Kelly Link is a really close approximation for where Machado probably is going to find herself for the rest of her career. And, it, you know, it's weird. So, like Kelly Link, she, Carmen Maria Machado, her book was a finalist for the Shirley Jackson Award, which is given for horror, and the Nebula Award, which is given for fantasy. And these are not the typical stories that you would assume would fall into that area, but they are like the literary version of that. And that's what Kelly Link sort of traffics in primarily as well.
So we should discuss the Law and Order story. Yeah. Let's get into it. I am going to admit I did not finish it. I made it maybe 10, 20 pages. And then I texted both of you guys to ask, is this really just going to be summaries of made up SVU episodes, which I have never seen a single episode of Law and Order SVU. I don't know who anybody is. I didn't get any of the references. I didn't know if it was actual summaries with new things added or if it was completely made up. And I really did not care. So that's like a huge misstep for me. Because, you know, I'll usually read anything, but 70 pages of that, no. And in a short story collection, I just wanted to move on to the next one. I'm not going to, like, and, you know, that's my problem, or where I stand on this book is, like, you have something as great as that first story, and then I think you have something that just fails and it just, you know, becomes a gimmick with this SVU thing. It just feels like, want to be George Saunders, want to be, you know, something clever. And I don't know what it's, I mean, did you guys get something out of it by the end that I should have stuck
with it? I think it was a case of the form idea was so exciting that like she rode away on the wave of the idea. You know what I mean? Like, because SVU has that many episodes, the story had to be that long and insane. And if it had been cut down to like a quarter of the size, I think I would have enjoyed it. Like, I liked the weirdness. I liked some of the like imagery, and I even liked the premise of it, which is, or I guess the emotional premise, which was like, why are we addicted to these stories about dead women? You know, I think that's a big question in our culture right now. And I would love to hear that like thought about more.
Totally.
But it was epic and not in a good way. Like, it wasn't the longest story in the collection because it needed to be in any artistic way. It was the longest story in the collection because SVU has a lot of episodes.
Right. So, okay. So I feel several ways about the story. The first way I was like, man, this would have been a great 1,000 word piece in McSweeney's, you know, the online version of McSweeney's. You can read it in the bathroom and you're like, oh, that was amusing.
Right.
And then I was like, well, gosh, if I had seen more than like 10 episodes of SVU in my life, this might be even more amusing. And then as I kept reading, as an hour elapsed in my reading life, I began to understand what she was going for at a higher level. So, okay. When we think of the great mythology of our time, it is television, right? And when we think about the mythologies that alter our landscape, that change our world, it is now, above all else, television. And so here she has undertaken a episode-by-episode retelling of the mythology of Law & Order SVU as something entirely different, except that what starts out as a funny premise, just like, oh, she's just going to keep doing that. and so while I get the larger purpose, and I understand that to actually go through and list every single episode of SVU and write a new description of what the episode is, and we'll read a few of them. Like, I understand that as an exercise in saying, this is what we've done. We have marginalized women to the point that we take the sexual violence against them as our entertainment for 27 seasons or whatever it is.
Right.
And here's what I have turned it into. Like, I almost thought this would be better as, this is going to sound absurd, but it would almost be better as like a modern art installation where it was changing in front of us every moment, you know, like the log line, and it would be like, you know, like the online TV guide thing. And instead of the normal thing, it would be this big thing.
That's a great idea.
Out.
And if you walked down like a long hallway with all of them written down, so you could see the accumulation in a physical way, but not have to fucking read every word.
Right.
Because you just could experience and be like impressed that the artist spent this long, you know, working on the project.
Yeah. I mean, I will argue that it did add up to more world building and a plot. Like, it wasn't a pointless list. So I just do want to throw that out there as well.
No.
But I agree. It needed something else.
Yeah, it becomes something larger than the conceit itself. But the conceit itself is like if you're just, it's like it's a Tuesday and you get home from your shitty job and you're like, I'm going to read a book for fun. And then you land on the 70-page retelling of every SVU episode. Like, I'm just going to watch SVU. It's going to be better for me. So let's read a couple of them. We can just pick them at random. So Ryder, since you didn't finish the story, give me a page number between 65 and 125.
118.
118, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to drop my finger down. This is from season 11. The episode is Savior. One night, Lucy knocks on Benson's door. Your gun, she says. Benson frowns at her. What? Lucy seizes the gun from Benson's holster. Benson makes a grab for it, but not before Lucy smears something on the handle. A gift from Father Jones, she says, handing it back to her. And this actually is season 2 of Law & Order SVU. Taken is the name of the episode. It was dark, says Stabler's wife. I was walking home alone. It was raining. Well, not really raining. Spitting, I guess. Misting. It was misting, and the light from the street lamps was all pooled and golden and thick as oil. And as I was breathing deeply, and it felt healthy, healthy, and right to be walking through that night. Stabler hears the drumming again. It shakes the water glass on the nightstand. Stabler's wife doesn't seem to notice.
Yeah, because she was raped. That's what that's about. All right. What a fun game this is.
Yeah. This is like classic corner with SVU. So it goes on like that for 70 pages. Yeah. I mean, so, okay. So this is something that I think about when making a short story collection. So I've written two. One was just an accumulation of stories I'd written over many, many years, and we put 10 of them together into a book. The second was a short story collection I wrote to be a short story collection. And then the third one that I'm doing now is a short story collection that I'm writing to be a short story collection. I wonder if she wrote these stories to be a story collection or if these are the stories she picked for her story collection. Because I think it matters. I think it makes a difference. Because a story like this, it doesn't actually seem like it fits with the other stories that are in here as it relates to the length, but also the cultural subject matter doesn't seem like it exactly lines up.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's more poppy and referential in a weird way. Yeah.
So I'm curious about that. And maybe it doesn't matter because maybe if you just read this, if you read a short story collection, you know, over the course of a month, you know, every day you read one other story or whatever, or every 2 days, then maybe it just feels like something cool and new that you're reading. But if you read it in a row, it really sticks out like a thumb.
Yeah.
And so that's an odd experience. And as a writer, when I'm writing a story collection, it's something that I think about. Like I want to put together the stories in a story collection so that it feels like you're reading a novel. Now, I know that sounds weird, but what I mean by that is emotionally, I'm trying to pay attention to what the reader is experiencing so that I'm putting in stories in a certain order to create the ebb and flow. Yeah, to create that ebb and flow emotionally. This freezes your emotion in place like deep freeze. Like I came out of that and I was like, well, I feel I'm numbed now. And it's an odd thing to stick in the middle of.
Although, to your point, it does come right after a really heavy story about abuse. So that is an interesting choice.
Are you talking about Mothers?
I think it's a. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. So Mothers kind of set for me, you know, once I got to Mothers, I started seeing a pattern in her writing that I think, you know, SVU story aside, kind of holds true for all of them except the first one, which is her stories begin incredibly overwritten. The prose itself, the level of detail, it's a little difficult. It's dense and it's hard to figure out, you know, because you don't know where you are in the world building. You know, you don't know what's going to be real or not. And then by the end of the story, it's underwritten. It's like she's withholding information from you or, you know, not describing scenes fully. So you don't really know what's kind of happening. And that felt a little tricky to me. You know, that her level of, you know, the level of information or the access you have to the characters or the plot itself recedes as the story goes on. And, you know, I think the Black Mirror comparison is apt.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a sort of like, there was a little bit of like wah wah at the end of every one of these stories for me, because you're reading like what's driving you is the mystery of like what is happening in the story.
Right.
Why are these people disappearing? Why is this, you know, where did this baby come from? What, you know, there's a question that begins every single one of these stories, like a big question, and it's a world building question. And she's overwriting to sort of cover up that question. And you're like desperately trying to get through the story and all this dense prose and really purple, you know, purple language. Like it's a little much at times, but you're willing to get through it because you're driven by a question mark that she's set up. But then by the end of most of the stories, it's she avoids answering the sort of central question, or she just hints at like, and yes, the body in the basement was real. And I said goodbye to it. And then I died or whatever. And you're like, wait. Did you just jump through, like, or, you know, Mothers, I don't really know what's going on. Like, I'm assuming she's having a mental break, but I don't know if the baby's real. I don't know what, you know, and it's a little unsatisfying, except for that first story, which is just perfect because it brings you back to exactly where you thought, which is the ribbon's going to come off and she's going to, her head's going to fall off. But in the meantime, you've learned so much and you've experienced so much, and it's been, she sort of maintains the same level of divulging information and scene work. Whereas in the other stories, it's like she retreats from scenes. She, you know, retreats from explaining what's going on, like actually literally, which can be okay. But in this case, it's a pattern throughout every one of these stories that kind of bothered me ultimately. And is, you know, I'm excited for her next collection because I feel like this has probably become obvious now and to her, hopefully. And I think she's so inventive, and I do think she's a brilliant thinker and at most times a brilliant writer. But, you know, there's nothing effortless the way that like George Saunders is effortless or Amy Bender feels effortless. Like their world building, the actual writing itself is breezy. You get through it very quickly. And so when you have those question marks, the mysteries of like, where is this going or where is this ending up? It's still an easy ride. Whereas this time, you know, they're like the Resident is a slog to get through at times.
Well, but in the Resident, she actually has a thesis statement essentially about everything that you're just talking about.
Yes.
So if you're reading along at home, it's on page 203. A character says to the narrator, "Do you ever worry about writing the mad woman in the attic story?"
Rude, and the narrator says, "Fuck you."
Pardon me?
Fuck you to that character. That was rude.
Yeah.
Is that Lydia? I hate Lydia.
Yeah. "I'm afraid I don't know what you mean. You know, the old trope. Writing a story where the female protagonist is utterly batty. It's sort of tiresome and regressive and, well, done." Here she gesticulated so forcefully that a few drops of red spattered the tablecloth. "Don't you think? And the mad lesbian, isn't that a stereotype as well? Do you ever wonder about that? I mean, I'm not a lesbian, I'm just saying." And then the narrator says, "She isn't batty or mad," I said finally. She's just a nervous character." And then she goes on to say, "She's me, more or less. She's just in her head a lot." And then Lydia says, "So don't write about yourself."
Rude again, Lydia. And then the narrator says,
"Men are permitted to write concealed autobiography, but I cannot do the same. It's ego if I do it." So, like, clearly the author recognizes this thing that she's doing, right? I mean, it's also in the Shirley Jackson vein.
Yeah.
And Julia just read that Shirley Jackson nonfiction book, so that's probably helpful. So it's in that Shirley Jackson vein of the batty woman in the attic or whatever. But so when you get to the Resident and she sort of breaks the fourth wall and talks about the thing that you've just experienced, then you're forced to ask sort of these larger questions. Now, for me as a, and for you guys too, I presume, as readers who are also writers and artists, you get to that and you're like, oh, that isn't that a fascinating discussion about the essence of art? But if you're just at home reading, are you like, oh, these self-indulgent fucks talking about themselves? Like, does the average person get turned off by that in the way that we find it amusing or interesting?
I got turned off by it. I mean, I'm an average person, I guess, because I totally got turned off by it because it felt like gimmickry to. It was like a way to point out the sort of biggest flaw in her writing, and therefore paper it up. You know, it felt like it didn't feel like that did not give more insight to the story. That just was a way for Machado to comment on her own writing and to comment on her own themes. And I didn't get much out of it. You know, like by the end of that story, I enjoyed that story actually, but I didn't get much out of it. I don't know what to think about it. And I'm not interested to keep thinking about it, actually. I liked the gothic, creepy ghost story version of it. And I kind of wish she'd just done that. Like, I kind of just wish she'd, you know, done a version that didn't need to be so self-reflective. Because I don't know what was added by that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ryder, in a way. Although, as usual, I think you're being, like, especially harsh. I don't think
Ryder's writing strong?
Is bad or anything.
Him?
I was feeling that you're talking about where I was, like, distracted by almost an excited way, which is bad too, of like, what's going on? I'm gonna figure it out, rather than just like living in each paragraph to paragraph. And I think the fiction like this that I really like Kelly Link was my big comparison to Todd, is like, I don't need to wonder if it's real, if what's happening is like really happening, because obviously it isn't. Right. It's fiction. So I'm completely fine with like a mound of flesh living in someone's basement and haunting them and then comforting them when they die. I don't need to wonder if like it's in her head or not, because it's in all of our heads because we're reading it. So I think playing with that is, I agree with you, Ryder, annoying, but reading it like 6 or 7 times for me had the opposite effect where I was like, this is just the theme of like the multiple selves and memories that women are occupying. So I ended up unbothered at the end of the road by what you're describing, precisely because it happens so many times. And in certain stories, like she does kind of just come out with what's going on. So to go back to the fashion one, which I really liked, even though it's the simplest and most obvious, which probably makes me a dum-dum, but whatever. I like that story.
It's a good story.
It's short.
I found my, well, the best part. I just enjoyed it as a love story.
Right. Yeah.
Like because it has this big idea, but then I was just like, oh, I'm emotionally invested in this couple and in this relationship. This is tragic.
But yeah,
so that was cool because that took me by surprise.
Women are fading away. We don't know where they go. Everyone's afraid they're going to fade away and they're scared. And here's some of the places they go. That's the entire story, plus the love story of the specific two characters we're following. But that one I didn't feel was withholding at all. It was saying like, you know, a lot of commentary that I think a lot of women at all ages, which is important for this story, can consider what fading away means, what giving their bodies to fashion means, or like wanting to fit into these creepy dresses means. I mean, there's a lot to chew on there beyond, you know, issue.
And then
crazy,
a story like Inventory, you know, so a story like Inventory, where it's an inventory of every person she ever has sex with. This is one of these things that I see a lot of. So I see a lot of stories like this where people are applying to graduate school and they've written a list story, and it's a list of everyone they had sex with, or a list of every house they lived in, or a list of every dog they had, or a list of every disease they've encountered, or whatever it might be. And so when I started this story, and it starts with Jurassic Park, so immediately I was interested. I was like, oh God, I've read this story before. And then though, it flips on its head completely. And so this is the point at which I think, okay, this is a writer who does not give a fuck about convention. And by not giving a fuck about convention, she forces the readers to feel uncomfortable at any given time. And I really like that. I like to be set off a little bit when I'm reading, if I'm not reading something that's plot heavy. So this is sort of the larger big question that I brought up at the beginning. Like, short fiction doesn't even need to have a plot anymore. It can just be about a character, about a character's experiences. And a story like this, which is a list of people she's had sex with, as it turns out, we descend into a dystopian reality. And you realize that everything that you thought you cared about these sexual relationships and the violence that accompanies them oftentimes, both physical and emotional, is playing out with the destruction of humankind at the same time. And do you care equally about both of them? Like, it starts to make you wonder, like, okay, if the world was collapsing, would I still be pissed off about petty indiscretions that my friends do against me or whatever, you
know? But it also the form makes sense. It's rationalized by the story at the end because it's about a disease. It's an epidemic that's spreading, and they don't know how it spreads. And so listing all your sexual partners and love relationships makes sense in that environment, you know, as a way to like keep a diary, because you're worried, you're wondering about all these people how are they dying off? Where are they now? You know, that. So the form made sense by the story, which is great.
Right. And using Jurassic Park as the metaphor at the
instant
top
win.
is a nice turn as well.
Another thing I emotionally loved about that story, just because I know a lot of women like this. So when you read the story, it feels like, oh, cheeky, fun list. And then it is revealed at the end that she's keeping lists as a way to like stay sane and like have some kind of control over this disintegrating universe. And that alone, the idea of keeping lists to grab some piece of control of your life as it's falling apart is, you know, very powerful, very cool. The list is a list for a reason, a lot of reasons.
Right.
And so that's the thing. So for listeners that are writers, if you're going to write a list story, and I've done some too, I think we probably all have at some point in our lives if we're writers, it's got to be more than the list. Like, it's got to be something that at the end has that gut punch. And this is an example of a list story that has a huge gut punch at the end. Yeah. And so it becomes really effective. And then it left me feeling like, oh, I want that in every single story in this book, because now I know she's capable of it in the best stories. And then in the stories where I don't feel it, I, like you, writer, I'm left feeling a little wah-wah by the end of it, and I don't want to feel that way.
Yeah.
But man, there's so much to admire in this book, and so much to admire from her as a writer and as a risk taker. I'm really excited to be able to give some of these stories to students to see what they make of them. And then it's going to be 8,000 different list stories of dystopia. I'm just
can you just send me the essay that explains the resident story to me, because I liked it but did not, it just left me feeling very disturbed.
Yeah, I'll have, when one of my students writes a 20 page paper on the resident, I will have her CC you on it.
So you know what's the reason I suggested that we read this book is because earlier this year, this is probably 4 or 5 months ago, I had two friends completely separately, male friends, who only one of them is a real big reader. As far as I know, the other one is a big comic book reader, but I don't think he reads fiction that much. They both independently were reading this book at the same time and talked to me about it. And they both loved it. And they wanted to talk about, you know, they couldn't wait for me to read it so we could talk about individual stories. And I was fascinated because I could tell just from the title and like the summary online that it was like clearly a female centric, you know, feminist book in a lot of ways. And I think it's interesting that it appealed to these two male readers completely separately. And I think that's a really good sign that the form and the inventiveness and the approach that this book takes, you know, it's effective. Like, I think it's, you know, it's potentially, I mean, I don't know how well this book did, you know, in terms of sales, but I'm assuming it did pretty well. And I just think it's great that these themes, she gets them under your skin, you know, and that's right. Cool. Like, and I think for you know, for guys to be reading a book about, like, you know, the ribbon story, but suddenly seeing it from this kind of perspective is really cool.
So this was up for the National Book Award in 2017. Yeah. And so it was up against the following books: Elliot Ackerman's Dark at the Crossing, which I'm not familiar with. Daniel Alarcon's The King is Always Above the People, which was also a short story collection. Charmaine Craig's book, Miss Burma. Charmaine Craig is my colleague at UC Riverside. And Miss Burma is a fantastic book. Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach, which we hated with a passion.
What?
Reserved for broccoli in my house. Lisa Coe's The Leavers. Min Jin Lee's Pachinko, Margaret Wilkerson Sexton's A Kind of Freedom, Jesmyn Ward's Sing Unburied Sing, which won the National Book Award, and Carol Zaref's Barren Island, which I don't have any knowledge of. The judges that year were Alexander Chi, Dave Eggers, and let's see. Oh, and Carolina, I can't pronounce her name, Wachlawiak. Were the judges. Oh, and Jacqueline Woodson was also a judge. So, like, you know, they had a pretty eclectic list of books that they picked. I had never heard of this book prior to you picking it, though.
Interesting.
Writer. So. I had never heard of it. Hmm. But, like, that was a year where the National Book Award was lauded for its diversity, which it clearly had a ton of. And I can understand why this book was picked. I can also understand why Jesmyn Ward's book won.
She just should have lost the SVU story. She probably would have won. I noticed that she got nominated and shortlisted a lot. And I think that that's because it is sort of unbalanced. You know, it's not a perfect book by any means. It has some perfect stories within it.
Yeah. Well, and seeing Dave Eggers was a judge for the National Book Award that year, it makes sense now that I thought that that one story
should have been on McSweeney's.
should have been McSweeney's. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, I really think for readers, this is absolutely a book that is valuable for you to pick up and read. I think there's a lot of good, important writing in it. I would read it slowly. I would not sit down and read it beginning to end
I think it's a fun book club book too. Yeah. If you're out there picking a book for your book club, I think this is a fun one to talk about, and for everyone to sort of be, you know, slightly scandalized by. That's a good, no, you know what I mean? Like those are always the best book club books, is when everybody's a little like made uncomfortable by the book and intrigued.
And there's a lot of entry points to talking about sexual violence, mm-hmm. which is hard, of course, to find books or topics that can give you a common language around it. And this book certainly will.
And again, though, if you have an issue with either the word straddle or slick, this is not your book.
And if you do, get over yourself.
Yeah.
Look into that. Don't you guys have words you don't like? Like, there's no word that makes you shiver?
I don't No.
You don't have a shiver word?
No.
Oh, we're going to ask our listeners what their shiver word is. I'm sure most of our listeners have a shiver word.
Well, they're all going to say moist, and I'm going to be moist, that was put in your brain by the internet.
See, moist no longer bothers me because it's my friend Mark's book title, so I've gotten used to it. Slick is still one of those words.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for LitHub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.